Get ready. Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is almost here. It's Black Friday in July, and it's coming your way. For 5 days only, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping on everything. Yes, everything right to your door. So mark your calendars. Wayfair's Black Friday in July sale starts July 24th. Shop everything home at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
The last thing they saw was someone they trusted. You're tuned in to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Dreeke.
We're going to dig into the case against Brian Koberger. Lots of controversy going on right now. And what some would say controversial tools being used in this investigation, investigative genetic genealogy, or IGG. And before you think, oh, this is junk science, this is scary, this is something new, it's really not. It kind of depends on if you're the prosecution or the defense and how it's going to weigh your way or not, if you're going to call it junk science. IGG has been around for a while. In the case of Brian Koberger, IGG playing a key role in connecting him to the crime scene. But with the defense now challenging its use, it raises questions about how investigators utilize such cutting-edge methods. Beyond the courtroom, IGG isn't just about DNA. It's about behavior, patterns, and the way suspects may unknowingly leave a trail. Joining us to discuss is retired FBI special agent and former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Dreeke. Robin, from your perspective, how does a tool like IGG change the behavior of a suspect when they're accused of it? And what kind of patterns do investigators look for once an initial DNA match points them in a direction like this with something like IGG?
It's so funny. Like you said, the patterns of behavior are what I'm always looking for first. And then, so it's either going to get clues from the DNA that's going to clue you in to look for patterns of behavior, or it's going to be the pattern of behavior is going to clue you in to look for DNA. And hopefully the two come together, because the two together make a really, really solid case. From what I understand in this case, I was listening to Robert, Robert Bloom wrote the book about this case?
Yep.
Yeah. And he was on Megyn Kelly's show, and he was talking about what the defense is really trying to do here with the collection of the DNA. It's a sequence of what databases they accessed and when that they're really going to be able to challenge here, which kind of really throws up a this is going to be maybe on the DNA side a little bit more challenging. But from what I understand, prosecution has plenty without it. So we will see. But yeah, it does change patterns of behavior. If you're trying to, especially if you're trying to mask yourself in your DNA. So we'll see. It's interesting.
It's something where they're questioning it, but they're more so seemingly questioning the methods as to which it was gotten. It's not so much the result of it being incorrect.
Right.
It's more so, did you do this correctly, ethically, whatever they want to throw out
yep.
there? Because at the end of the day, it leads to Koberger. They just don't want a jury to know that it leads to Koberger. That's the most simplistic way I can put it, where they got the IGG data from the father. They went back, compared it down to who they suspected and where it might be in Moscow. They eventually arrest Koberger. They do a swab on Koberger and then compare that to the initial IGG and discover, oh, yes, this pretty much has to be our guy. Because it's all there. There's no possible way in this equation that it's somebody else's DNA. It's not an option. It's not like, well, it's one in four. It's like one in some billion is what the number truly is. So It's 100% Koberger's. The question will then be, well, how did it get on this knife sheath that then matches Koberger and his IgG and then his actual DNA when they discovered that? If the IgG stays in this case, which I'm thinking it probably will, what kind of a defense does Koberger have? Because this is, I mean, they're throwing things at the wall. You know, he likes going for drives at night and looking at the stars. Didn't seem to have that much excitement to it. Nobody really jumped onto that going, oh, of course, that explains it. He didn't kill anybody. But this pretty much shows that he was at least there, or his DNA was on the knife sheath at some point in time. If this does not get thrown out and it all goes into court, does he have an argument if this knife sheath is there?
I don't think so. If the knife sheath is there and they got the DNA and it's admissible, I think he's done. Because now look at the behavior pattern. Without this, we got a lot of reasonable doubt to me. Because without this, and we were just talking about this, most murders, there's a connection somewhere between the victim and the murderer. And they still, again, everything's still under seal, so we don't know, but we still haven't seen any actual linkage between Koberger and any of the girls I think there might have been like one potential data point there where there was, but that's why defense is really hinging on putting everything to try to throw out the IgG, as you're saying, the DNA, because the DNA makes it really, really solid. It's 100%. It's his on that knife sheet. But again, how it got there, well, it's a touch DNA on that thumb snap. So, but again, it's the data. I know the only thing they're challenging is the database that the feds used to access it when they had permission to do it. Like, what came first, a chicken and the egg on this, I think, is what defense is going after, if I understand it right.
And at the end of the day, does it really matter? I mean, I guess to procedure it might, but there doesn't even seem to be really any answers to this is improper use of it and this is proper use of it. There doesn't seem to be really any rules around, other than somebody saying, well, that doesn't seem fair. Great. To you, it doesn't. To the victims, and it led to supposedly the killer here, it means a lot.
Yeah, so the collection of it from the knife sheath follows regular procedure. I think the way they got it, I'm trying to remember as I'm listening to it on the other show. I think the way they were able to get it from both a cheek swab, which actually came after he was arrested, but actually what led to his arrest, it was I know the big question is, how did law enforcement know, the locals know, to go after Koberger if they hadn't accessed and put that DNA into a database that they, so that's what it was. They collected the DNA, the touchpoint DNA off the night sheaf, but the dad's DNA was not in a database that was normally accessible to the FBI at that time. And so how did they make the leap from one system to the other to find out to go after him and target? I think that's what the defense is going after. Like you said, from what I understand, not being the lawyer side, but from what I understand and what I'm seeing, it's not going to make a tinker dam's difference.
Yeah.
But I think that's why defense is going at it hard.
Are they going at it hard because they think they truly have a legal argument? Or is this more so another, let's throw this into the ether of the public. We don't have a jury yet. Let's throw everything we can possibly put out there and get it into somebody's mind, because all you need is one, that this is not a reliable source in any way, shape, or form that they can, whether saying it's junk science, whether it was captured illegally or wrongly or unethically or whatever they're going to try and say. Get that out there. It doesn't have to be a legal argument right now. Just get it in people's minds that this is not a reliable source of evidence. Is that what you think they're kind of doing here, more so than they really think this will get thrown out?
I think that's the hope and the prayer, that people are going to think that, even though that's really implausible if you dive even just like 1 inch below the surface on understanding how reliable this data point is. So I think that's plan B, is to sow some seeds of doubt. Plan A is to really try to get it out to use it to get it hell out, so defense doesn't have to worry about it, because without it, they can sow those seeds of doubt, so you don't have a beyond reasonable doubt jury when it comes to going for either life in prison or firing squad, as they're saying is now in place in Idaho.
Does it surprise you at all that we have all of this technology now that really, I mean, it narrows things down to such a fine point where we can really, without a doubt, in many cases, identify the perpetrator of crimes in ways that we couldn't do years ago. Yet, we have more doubt being cast on these methods than ever thought possible. Of course, your defense of somebody's going to, if they're not using it for their advantage, they're going to say, this is not accurate, this is not real. But at some point, how are we doing this? There is fact and there is not fact. Some things like this, like science, where the DNA is there, that seems to be a thing. Cell phone data, that's another one that they're going to try and argue that Koberger's cell phone data is different than what was interpreted by the FBI and the investigators in this case. The data that shows, the Cellbright data that shows him near the house, the phone going off. There's a lot that points to him being around the means of that house for a lot of time before the murders even occurred, and including on that night. But the fact that we can go in and an attorney can argue that, well, my expert over here says this phone data doesn't say this, and this one over here says that. That's got to be insanely confusing for a jury when they're not experts in this. They're relying on an expert. How can you have two different experts saying two completely different things about data that is pretty much there and set in stone and doesn't lie?
You know, that's a great question, but that's why they're not presenting all this evidence to a scientist.
Yeah.
You know, a cognitive, unbiased scientist. You're presenting it to a jury. That's, you know, and so it's up to both the defense attorney and the prosecution to understand who the jury is. And they're going, you know, one side's going to try to confuse them and sow seeds of doubt by mumbo jumbo, and the other side's going to try to make it more solid and simplistic. So it comes down to how well their experts can communicate and make the complex simple for whatever the jury is composed of, but maybe it's not a jury that's composed of people that need it, you know, simple. So it really comes down to, every trial comes down to the jury. You know, what do they need to see? How do they need to see it? How do they need to be presented? And just the courtroom presentation. This is what, you know, Koberger's defense attorney is doing really well anyway, always placing them in a suit, keeping them well-groomed, you know, all these things. I mean, I have my friends from the FBI. They do great, huge classes on ways and the types of jackets even that lawyers should wear in a courtroom in order to weigh the jury to their side. The number of buttons they should have, the colors of shirts they should wear. I mean, there is a huge science behind how to appeal to a jury or anyone or even a judge in this matter. So it's there's a lot behind these things. And so it really depends.
Koberger's education in criminology, being a teacher, he got fired obviously right before the crimes were committed, but he was, you know, he was a PhD criminology student. He knew a lot about the field. Obviously, you know, it's not like being in the field and actually living it, but he, you know, had a good knowledge well beyond the average Joe. Do you think that's going to play a role in any of this for the defense or the prosecution, that they can use that to their advantage, proving or trying to disprove his involvement in a case like this?
I would think the prosecution might try to use it just to show the steps he took to use his knowledge, to lose his backgrounds, to gain the types of knowledge he had in order to carry out the crimes the way he did. But again, kind of like from the very early, that my get-go of the entire thing, when looking at him and watching him and seeing the way these things are committed, it looked literally like a student that had studied this without the experience of having done it once. Because, you know, it was executed and it was planned very, very well, whether it was him or someone else. It was executed poorly. There was missteps, and luckily those missteps were in a huge area, and being number one, the knife sheath. I mean, that was the biggest one there. Throwing, you know, and between that and boxing up your trash and throwing it in the neighbor's trash during the same time period that you might be a suspect in this, that was also a huge, hey, I know I shouldn't throw it in my trash, but having never seen cops and how they conduct trash covers, you have no idea on actually how they're conducted. You just know they're conducted, so let's put it in the neighbor's trash.
That's why he was using rubber gloves. Like, I just use rubber gloves, I'll never be caught.
Yeah. Except when you bought the knife that you use in the killing and the first time, and when you didn't buy it from wherever you bought it from, when you didn't walk into the Walmart or when you got it on Amazon, it shows up to your house. You should have unwrapped it with gloves on.
Yeah, that was a second thought, though. But after the fact, wear the gloves, bleach the car, no one will know the difference. I'm most fascinated about what we don't know in this case yet of evidence that they have that they will present because it's been sealed. I'm going to guess there's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, and just think about this, too. I mean, so getting rid of the clothes he was wearing, he or whoever did it, as well as the murder weapon, that was part of the plan because he knew that that's what you have to do. But you forgot the knife sheath where you committed the murder. That was big, bad boo-boo. But also, you know, from what we understand and what the conjecture is, he wasn't there to kill all four.
Yeah.
And so when startled, when faced with reality, you know, in other words, he had a standard operating procedure of what he was trying to attempt to do. But when the first round goes down range, like they say in combat, chaos breaks out and your plan goes to hell.
Yeah.
And so he didn't have plan B ready, and plan B went to hell. And so his brain went to lockdown. It's why the author said that had what's the one girl survivor's name? I
don't have it in front of me, but yeah.
Yeah, she survived because she didn't speak, is his conjecture, mm-hmm. because she didn't make herself part of his, even though he had like tunnel vision, whoever it was, whether it's him or someone else, had tunnel vision moving out of that place because chaos happened and he was reacting to the environment around him and new stimulus coming in.
Yeah.
He didn't make herself a new stimulus, hence she survived, you know, thankfully. That's what happened. You know, he had tunnel vision and went, and he was going for one, and he was confronted with many, and it caused him, I think, to make some missteps on the scene itself, which led us to hopefully having a conviction here at some point because of the DNA.
It makes me wonder what was that moment like when he realized, oh shit, I left the sheath there. And I'm wondering if in his mind he thought, I'll just go back and get it, because there are allegedly sightings of him, like, driving by. It was more in the morning when the investigation was beginning and once people had kind of woken up and realized there was bodies in the house, because remember that was a long stretch of time before police ever arrived, which is kind of odd to begin with. But he supposedly was driving around there. I'm wondering if he thought he was going to be able to get back in and go grab that sheath and get out, or is it just common that person of this nature, if in fact it is him, to go visit the scene of the crime once the circus begins as people start discovering the carnage?
More common to go back to the scene and see the circus, see the carnage, kind of judge and gauge, you know, what their reactions. In other words, he's seen if it looks like they're running out of there and they know exactly what they're doing, or they kind of taking their time because they don't know, they don't have anyone that they're looking for. So placing myself the best we can, doing that deep, you know, context from his perspective. So here he is. He's got plan A. He's got plan B. He's very well thought out, very methodical about what he did. He tried to mitigate all his things by what he covered himself with, the gloves he was wearing. So worst case scenario, he now leaves the scene. He's like, oh, my God, I left a knife sheath behind. But because his arrogance and his confidence and his pre-plan, he's probably saying, but it's okay. I was wearing gloves. I did all these things. And so rather than risk going back in and get it, I'll just rest assured that I did things the right way. Never thinking in a million years they're going to get touch DNA off that thumb snap.
Kind of a dumb thing to assume.
Well, what are you going to do at that point, right?
Yeah, exactly. What are you? Yeah, exactly. Just hope to God that it's not there. And it could have been, you know, had he been smarter with that, there might have been no DNA on it. And then he would have never, you know, that would have stopped the investigation, would have never really gotten it off the ground to go in his direction initially.
And who knows what sort of DNA collection he had studied up to that point. True. I had never heard of touch DNA until I think it was, I'm not sure if it was this case or the Rachel Morin case. There was one case in the last 2 years when the first time I heard of touch DNA. Mm-hmm. And so that's even more advanced. It's literally basically from a thumbprint.
Yeah.
It's literally just touch. You can get enough off of that, you know? And so he might've gotten to the point where in his studies that it's gotta be a hair, it's gotta be something under the nails. And that's why he's wearing full coveralls, whoever it was, you know? So I think, and he thought he might've mitigated all that he knew about. He might not have known about that. That's a possibility as well.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
You're in the thick of a true crime saga, every detail sinking in. And then, wham, a commercial about something you couldn't care less about. It's like being served a microwaved dinner at a five-star restaurant. But it doesn't have to be this way. Go for True Crime Today, Premium Plus, on Apple Podcasts. With True Crime Today, Premium Plus, you get uninterrupted, ad-free episodes, extended interviews that dig even deeper into the muck, and early access so you can brag to your friends. It's like ordering the secret menu at a crime buffet. So, search for True Crime Today, Premium Plus, on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and savor every twisted detail without interruption.